She was flustered now, scattered. The car was going faster. I waited a second before I asked, "Are you feeling all right? Do you need—" "I am clearly not physically ill over something that you have done to me. You might be dense, but right now you're being extraordinarily stupid." I knew her well enough to know when she was pissing me off on purpose, but this had a different feel than usual. Usually, when she went after me with teeth and nails, it was because something else had frustrated her and I happened to be in the same room. She liked to have something concrete to fight with. It wasn't my favorite thing about her, but it wasn't the worst either, and she normally ran through her rages in a minute or two. And yes, we'd had a heart-wrenching fight earlier, and yes, it might have been something we couldn't come back from, but when Holmes was truly angry with me, she didn't throw out petty insults or tell me to look up the Berlin Wall on my phone. The last time she went after me with this kind of viciousness, it was to chase me out of her lab before we were both killed by an explosion. It couldn't be true. I turned to stare out the back window of the car. It was dark, and I didn't know the city, but I also didn't think I remembered the giant industrial buildings we were passing now. We were going deeper into whatever neighborhood we'd been in. We definitely weren't on our way back to Greystone. Holmes was staring at me. "Look at your phone," she'd said. So I did. It was back in service. She'd been texting me this whole time. "This isn't a Greystone car. Get out. I sent an SOS to August and Milo. They'll come for me. Go. Go now." Before I could begin to form a plan or say, "No, I'm not leaving you. We'll get ourselves out of this," the car came to a crashing halt. Even though I was buckled in, I slammed forward into the divider. "Get out," Holmes said hoarsely, not bothering to whisper. "They're not interested in you." "What is happening?" I wanted to ask. "And why is this happening now?" The driver climbed out and slowly rounded the back of the car. I reached out for her hand. "Jesus, Watson," she said, and her face was clear and shining. "This is going to get ugly." "I know," I told her. "I'm not going anywhere." And the black-clad driver yanked me out of the car with his massive fists and shoved me up against the windshield. I put up a good fight. That was my job, wasn't it, to be the brawler? I was playing my role. He had a normal face, the face of a dry cleaner or a dog walker or an old friend of my mother's, but he was some stranger, someone I'd never seen before, and he was punching me in the face. It was stupid to be so surprised at it. All we did was lurk around the edges of this kind of danger, so why was it such a shock to be hauled into the center of it by my shirt and then have my nose broken? "Run!" I yelled. Where was Holmes? I couldn't see her anywhere. I was trying to buy her time. This man had 100 pounds of muscle on me, and I wasn't a skinny kid. When he hit me in the jaw, I heard something splinter. It didn't matter. I couldn't hear, couldn't see, and it wasn't because of the blood streaming down my face. It was because I was furious. I hooked my leg around his and took him down. Thank God for rugby, I thought with some bitter, distant irony, because I had him on his back now. He was scrabbling against me, ready to fling me off, and I knew nothing about street fighting when it came down to it, but I did know to jam my fingers into his eyes. With his forearms, he flung me backward and lumbered back up to his feet. Through the blood in my eyes, I saw Holmes behind him. What had she been doing? Why hadn't she run, gotten help? But she was here, wrenching the driver's arm behind his back. With her cool, calm efficiency, she kicked out his knees with her sharp-heeled boots, but she was calling for help all the while. He turned and gave her a shove that sent her sprawling on the ground. I shouted her name. I shouted it again. Was this the warehouse district? I listened for cars, sirens, any sign of human life, and then I stopped listening because all I could hear was the driver's grunts as he slammed his fist into my stomach. I tried to heave him off me, but I couldn't. It was like I was being beaten up underwater. Time was moving that slowly. It was so impersonal. I'd never known that fighting for your life was so invasive and so cold. Had it been 5 minutes? An hour? On the pavement behind him, Holmes groaned and sat up, her face scratched red with gravel, and I couldn't look anymore because he was punching me in the mouth. I told her to run, or tried to. I ended up spitting out a thick stream of blood, and just as the driver pulled back for another blow, I saw Holmes struggle up to her feet. "Don't kill him," a voice said, but it wasn't hers. Where was I? "My brother won't be happy." I think the driver nodded. I couldn't see, not out of both eyes, and my head was beginning to loll on my neck. "Sorry, kid," he whispered, two words so surprising that I almost choked, and when he hit me again, it kicked me off the ladder of consciousness and sent me falling down, down, down.
10. First and foremost, I should say that I am providing this account under great duress, and only with the reassurance that Watson will not read it for a period of 18 to 24 months after the events in question. Contrary to what he believes, I don't take any joy in upsetting him. He asked me to fill in some particulars about the period of time in which he was incapacitated, and to tell it in a way that appeals to the listener. "No info dumping, Holmes," he'd said. If I'm to do this, I'll do it on my own terms. Here are the facts. We were locked in Hadrian and Philippa Moriarty's basement. It had a very plush red carpet on which Watson was currently sprawled. They had tied me up, but I'd made short work of my bindings. All of this was August's fault. I'm not sure if you remember this particular detail from his last account of our adventures, but it takes Watson an absurd amount of time to wake up after he's been knocked unconscious. You might make the argument that I should know this, that a good partner would in fact actively and successfully prevent such occurrences. Your assumptions would be correct, but I do try to prevent such things. Why else would I have left him in Milo's sad little hotel? Before we'd arrived, I'd asked my brother to stock our room with paperback classics and murder mysteries, Jamie Watson's Poison, if you'll excuse the expression, and I hoped that he'd be engrossed enough in Slaughterhouse 5 to not notice that, from time to time, I would slip out to do some work on my own. The fact that Milo ordered those books in German is an unfunny joke and hardly my fault. Yes, I was upset with Watson. I was quite upset in point of fact, but it was nothing in comparison to the anger I felt when I saw his worried, sick face over the shoulder of my Mark. Of the two of us, I am the only one who has successfully solved a crime. I am, in fact, the far more competent partner, not to mention equipped with far better foresight. These aren't boasts. These are quantifiable facts. Here is something I can't say to Jamie Watson. I can't be your girlfriend, because I'm terrified you'll try to wrap me in cotton and hide me away. Try being the operative word. He needs saving far more often than I do. But there, at least, I'd failed. Watson laid out on that plush carpet was disturbing for a number of reasons. Every few minutes I made sure that he was breathing, and in the time between I sat on my heels beside him, considering our situation. The basement had no visible doors or windows. Our phones had been confiscated and the back of my head was bleeding. I would give myself and Watson 10 minutes of rest before I began ripping apart the wooden furniture to fashion myself a weapon. My father trained me to prioritize in situations like this. Make a concrete list, he'd said. Be unsparing. A list, then. What were my priorities? 1. Keeping myself alive. Note that it may appear mercenary to put this first, but anyone who doesn't have this at the top of their list is a parent or a liar, and I am neither. Not to mention that failure to keep myself alive renders the rest of this enterprise moot. 2. Keeping Jamie Watson alive, as his reckless disregard for his own safety works against him. Neither of us believes that we personally need caretaking. The other disagrees. He and I find ourselves at an impasse. As very recent events have proved, Watson will throw himself into a physical altercation he knows he will lose in an attempt to buy me time to run away. Clearly he needs caretaking, if not a thorough head examination. 3. Recovering my uncle. Because Leander never goes without leaving me some small present, a book on vivisection, a pheasant quill, and nothing can rouse him in the middle of the night, there is quite literally no situation I can imagine that would lead my uncle to willingly leave his bed between the hours of 10 and 4. Most importantly, he has never, ever called me Lottie, not since I told him I hated the name when I was 7. That said, he can and does take care of himself. For that reason, one would argue I should move him further down the list. 4. My parents. How to put this? Ideally, they would remain living. That said, I cannot imagine them as anything other than alive anyway, as they are capable, ruthless, and wealthy enough to make the best of those two other attributes. Jamie would call them vampires. This term also has appealing qualities. I am aware of their disappointment in me, which I once found motivating and now find tedious. I have a somewhat vague desire to rescue them just to prove them wrong. That said, I don't wish them to be poisoned, though I can understand Lucien's desire to give it a shot. That is one of those things Watson wouldn't want me to say out loud. You're awful, he'd say. They're your parents. At times, Watson is far too sentimental. I've yet to see him with a puppy, but I imagine it would be too much for me to handle. Nota bene. My brother does not appear on this list because he has approximately 72,000 armed guards and an ego the size of a small blimp. All of the above items have been carefully ranked. They all must come before number 5, the hardest of all, which is to keep Watson happy. One might argue that I rank this the lowest on my priority list because it proves to be the most difficult, and I dislike failure. What does Watson want? To have us at our happiest, and also to be in romantic love. In our case, because I am a bit of a broken robot, to use his words, these two things are mutually exclusive. He is a boy, and he is in love with me, but only because the world bores him. His world is boring because it loves him, you see. Of course it does, and so it all comes so easy to him, and his world grows wretched and long, and he begins casting around for something of interest in all that dark. If I am broken, at least my hazard lights are appealing to a boy like him. Personally, I've often thought that Watson and I had all the trappings of a standard romantic relationship. Absolute exclusivity, obsessive intensity, constant arguments, crime-solving, and have been confused as to what more he wants. Sex, of course, but that's a small thing. An unwieldy, impossible, giant, small thing. My last romantic relationship wasn't categorically romantic per se, but it certainly also involved crime. Carload of cocaine, local constabulary, etc. Watson still hadn't stirred. By my count, I had 3 more minutes before I should begin dismembering an armchair. Looking down at him, at his closed eyes and battered face, I began to think. I thought perhaps Watson had a brain injury. Perhaps there was a chance that he wouldn't wake up. Perhaps I would be left in this basement alone, and then killed, or even worse, rescued by my omnipotent asshole of an older brother, and then left to contend with August Moriarty, human conscience, alone. And if so, I wouldn't ever see Watson again do the thing where he almost trips over a curb when crossing the street and overcompensates by windmilling his arms. And if that was the case, I would certainly never again be able to say his name, Watson, in the way I say it to him, with affection, and also a certain kind of despair. And then I forbade myself from thinking any more about Watson at all. The best way to help him was to disregard him for the time being. I've often found this to be the case. The basement was sparsely furnished, and I took the likeliest-looking chair and broke off its legs by bashing it against the floor. Taking the sharpest-looking piece of wood, I tested it for length and weight and then knelt again next to Watson on the floor. I checked him over. He was still breathing, his eyelashes beginning to flutter, but he didn't respond to either my touch or my voice. With luck, in another 2 minutes he would be ready to go. I reviewed what I'd gathered about our situation. This wasn't Hadrian and Philippa's primary residence. No self-respecting bon vivants would live in the warehouse district, and the walls were cinder block under their paint. We'd been taken to some secondary property. From the mix of preserving chemicals in the air, I assumed that we were in a facility where they falsely aged the art they produced. Even if I broke us out through the window well, I'd still have an incapacitated Watson and an empty road in the middle of nowhere. Milo was in Thailand, and while I know he kept a tail on me most times, I wasn't sure how or how quickly he'd respond to my texts. Before they'd taken my phone, I had sent a contingency message to an old friend, asking for aid and transportation. I would wait on that. Any bug Milo had placed on me had been hacked by the Moriartys, most likely after Hadrian's bodyguard regained consciousness and called his boss. That car had come at my request. I took the next 27 seconds to locate that bug. He'd had it sewn into the sleeve of my jacket, and then crushed it with my boot. Really, this was August's fault as much as anyone else's. If my read on him last night was correct, one untied shoe, his keys nearly falling out of his back pocket, August had immediately ditched Nathaniel and gone to Hadrian for help in finding Leander. August, like me, was never that untidy. August, even when driven to his absolute limits, would never threaten to kill a man's parents. August would assess the situation and go to his brother to attempt to broker a deal. Milo had called it exactly. "He'll go to Hadrian," he'd said in my ear right before he left, "and when the dust settles, we'll know exactly how he's involved. Just bide your time." Who, indeed, needed money and resources when one had a Moriarty with a heart three sizes too big? I couldn't blame him, really. Families were complicated animals. Through the thick walls, I could hear a banging sound upstairs. It had the hollow ring of someone battering a wooden door. August, most likely, in full martyr mode. I hadn't quite forgiven him either for bringing Watson to that party. Boy problems, I thought to myself, and when I tapped Watson's shoulder again this time, I did it rather harder than I needed to. His eyes flew open. "Holmes," he said. It was a horrible croaking sound. His mouth was swollen, his jaw too, and his eyes, and his nose was broken. Looking at him, I began deciding which of Hadrian's fingers I would stomp on first. "Don't talk," I told Watson, because I didn't want him to strain. "Listen to me. I'm about to scream. I'm telling you so that you don't physically react. There will be a body. I'll remove it. We'll hold you up the stairs, and one or the other of them up there will give us an address, and then my contact will help us arrange transportation to Prague." This was more information than I usually gave, so I was unsurprised by Watson's apparent confusion. "Ready?" I asked. He blinked, which I took for assent. I made my preparations. With my fingers, I streaked the blood on my forehead down my face. I coated my hands in it. I hefted my makeshift club, feeling something like a warrior god, and positioned myself behind the locked door. Then I began to cry. Softly at first. I turned up the volume slowly, as one would a dial, letting the tears call up a corresponding thickness in my throat. When I began to keen, I wanted the sound to be genuine.
"Jamie,"
I whispered. He turned his head to look at me. I could tell it hurt. "Not you," I mouthed, and said his name again.
"Jamie! Oh, God, Jamie! Please don't! Please, please breathe!"
This part was necessary. I didn't know if anyone was standing on the other side of the door.
"You can't be dead,"
I said, and took my voice louder, higher in pitch. I hunched my shoulders and brought my hands up over my face.
"You can't be! You promised! You promised me London, you... God, could you just breathe? Please start breathing again. I'll do anything. I don't care what I am to you. I'll be anything, do anything, please, please."
By then I was taken over by it, the grief, the fury, and I let myself dig in deeper, deeper, as far down as I could go. I'd lost him. He'd gone. Not in the way I'd imagined, him slamming his way out the door in the middle of the night. We'd be in uni, or he would, as I belonged in uni as much as I belonged anywhere else, which was to say not at all, but we'd have a little flat, maybe in Baker Street, that would have a kitchen and a good library, and at least one room in which no one was allowed to speak to me under any circumstances barring fire, and it would be good between us, until one night we'd be in bed, and the old horror would rise up in me again, where he'd touch me, and I'd well up with it, that feeling of wrongness. How I'd been suckered into letting anyone touch me like this again. How had I allowed it? Who was this person, and why was he touching me? And it was a con. I'd been conned by him, or myself, or both of us, and I'd either break down entirely or throw him out. And in the end, in how it played out in my head, it was always me throwing him out, and I'd want him to leave as much as I never wanted him to go. But we wouldn't have that, would we? We wouldn't even get to that point. He'd be taken away from me by something else, something before that, some peripheral affair I'd dragged him into. Something like this, a missing uncle, a man with a taste for my blood, and he wouldn't leave on his own 2 feet, no. Instead, we'd have a gun, or a virus, or a knife to the throat, or this, him yelling for me to run while I stood like some dumb animal, watching a Moriarty bully boy take him apart piece by piece, and I was useless. And then we got into shelter, only for me to watch him die on the ground. And Watson, I heard myself say it now, aloud, Watson, please, please. And I broke down into some approximation of hysterical sobs. If you're going to take on a persona, my father used to tell me, it can't be a persona. You have to believe it. I was very good at what I did. I believed all of it, everything, always. I was so caught up in it, in fact, this private recitation of my worst fears, that when the door did swing open, I nearly forgot what to do. But I was in position, hidden behind the door and out of view. I hefted my table leg.
"Where's the boy?"
the thug said gruffly, taking 2 steps into the room, and it was mere luck that he didn't see me, and more that he had no one behind him. "Here," I said, and knocked him on the head. He went down with the usual speed. I took the ring of keys from his hand and rolled him into the corner. Luckily, he was not the man who'd roughed up Watson, or I would have struck him again. "Oomph," Watson was saying, and when I returned to his side, it was clear that he was only semi-conscious. It took some coaxing, but I managed to get him to his feet, propping him up against my shoulder. He's largely muscle, which makes him quite heavy, and while this was something I had of course noticed, and yes, appreciated, I am in fact a heterosexual human girl, I didn't like having to haul him out the door. He supported some of his own weight, but not nearly enough. The hallway was empty, as I knew it would be, and there was a set of stairs on either end. I stood there listening, aware that Watson was bleeding on me while I in turn bled onto the carpet. While I calculated the odds of either staircase being the more direct route to our destination, I thought also about the state of my boots, which Lena had coaxed me into buying on something called a flash sale site, an experience I found traumatic enough to never want to do it again. A timer ticked down, telling me how long I had to keep these hypothetical boots while I typed in my bank information, and it made me think of all the false scarcity we had in our lives. 1 shoe left, act now, 1 more day for this sale, and the way the boy leaning on my shoulder was coughing now, low in the throat, was ringing an awful bell somewhere in my head. Scarcity and plenty, boom and bust, this being the only time in my life that I'd ever have this, and then it would be over, done, never... But that was the undercurrent to my thinking. The rest of me, as always, knew what to do. The west hallway. We would take the stairs 1 at a time. I had been waiting since last night for the Moriartys to make their move. Here we were. "Review your facts," my father said, "before you build deductions on top of them." The facts were obvious. This is what I had deduced. We were being kept in the basement because we were children, and therefore supposedly collateral. Milo had gone away. I'm sure that last night Hadrian had managed to weasel that fact out of his guileless little brother, and Hadrian saw his opportunity. He would make a point to his older brother Lucian that he was capable of doing what, to Hadrian's mind, Lucian could not do. That is to say, punishing me for what I'd done to baby brother August. After all, I was still alive. This is all idiocy, of course. Lucian was doing a lovely job. My mother poisoned, my father somehow still in fine fettle, a multitude of cameras in the family home, a live-in physician, and no evidence to be found. Was I or was I not puzzling through this at least once every 7 minutes? Yes, of course I was. If Lucian was interested in killing me, I would be dead, Milo or no. No, toying with me was Lucian's hobby, and one's hobby stops being a hobby once it's buried beneath an angel statue in an excruciatingly posh cemetery. I had never worried about Lucian murdering me. I worried about Lucian murdering Watson. Think of the endless mental trauma. It would be exquisite, a masterpiece of revenge. Think of the iterations. Exhibit 1, in which I am framed for Watson's murder. Exhibit 2, in which I do in fact kill Watson. For example, am put into an impossible situation where I must slit his throat or see a city explode. Exhibit 3, in which I do, and Lucian explodes the city anyway. Exhibits 4 through 29, the last of them so wretched I couldn't even consider it. Watson leaned more heavily against my shoulder. He'd stopped moving his own legs, but his breath in my ear let me know he was still alive. We'd reached Philippa's office. I knew it was hers because of the way in which the carpet was worn. A woman's heel had tread this, and often, a tall heel, judging by the pressure points, and I'd seen her wearing stilettos at our horrid lunch. Just inside the door, her bodyguard checked the time. I could hear the snap of his phone as he locked it. This one would be a bit more complicated. 2.5 minutes later, I'd put the unconscious bodyguard through the window, and I had his gun trained on Philippa Moriarty. It wasn't particularly good to see her again. She looked much the same. Her face had a pinched, appraising look I most often associated with toddlers. "What do you want?" We had approximately 30 seconds more before her baby brother arrived with the cavalry. The battering sound at the door had finally stopped. There was no use worrying about August. What was done, and anyway I'd seen that he carried a knife in his boot. I hoisted Watson up. His legs were beginning to go, and with an effort he managed to straighten them. His eyelashes were fluttering. "Where is it?" I asked Philippa. "Where is what, exactly?" With my other hand, I clicked the safety off my gun. 20 seconds. Where is the auction being held, and at what time? Because the halls I dragged Watson down, on this floor and the one below it, were filled with paintings. Paintings with quite a lot of black paint, and sad-looking young Edwardians looking at glass scarabs and their hands and microscopes and each other. This was a storage facility, but she was pleased with her wares and proud of herself, her crown jewels, these forged Hans Langenberg paintings. And what is a Moriarty, if not someone who gilds their abattoir? Watson, when you read this, I do hope you appreciate my restraint in reserving this information until now. Of course they would be sold to buyers through her private network. The question was only when. "January," she said. "The 27th. It's a pity that you aren't dead, Charlotte." "Yes, well, we all have our crosses to bear," I said. "January is too late. You'll have one sooner." "When?" She spat the word. "Tomorrow." "Why on earth should I do that?" "Because I'll expose you. Because I'll send every last bit of information I've gathered on your operations to the government. Because if you don't, I will have my brother hit this warehouse 20 minutes from now in a precision strike that he'll write off as a training exercise, and then, for good measure, I'll do your house. Because I'm holding a gun, you cow, and I am perfectly capable of making your death look like a suicide." In that moment, I wasn't entirely sure I was bluffing. "Fine," she said at length. "Where?" I took a few steps forward. The office had concrete floors and Watson's shoes skittered along them. "At your auction site in Prague. You still use that museum after hours? Give me the address." She hesitated. My time was up. I could hear the feet pounding up the stairs. Very, very carefully, as one must be in these situations, I shot out the panel of glass above her head. She screeched.
"Philippa!"
someone called below. "You will, in fact, give me the address, or I'll have all of your assets frozen by the morning." I thought for a moment. "And your new orchid gardener sent on permanent vacation."
"Without your brother, you'd be toothless," she said.
"Accurate. Unfortunately for you, he's very much alive. The address, now." She gave it to me. It was in Prague, in Old Town, and I committed it to memory. The footsteps in the hall now. Watson moaned, low in his throat. Under his weight, I'd lost all feeling in my left shoulder. "We turn our phones," I said. She placed them on the table. I caught them both up in a hand. "Thanks. You've been a great help."
"Don't you want to know what's happened to your uncle?" she said to me. "Don't you care at all?"
I knew what had happened to Leander. I hadn't wanted to believe it. I had insisted to myself that I needed to find firm evidence, but the truth of it was I had known, bodily known, not known with my brain, and so perhaps not legitimately, but my heart had been saying it since the day we'd left Sussex. My heart, the absurdity of it. I knew, too, that there was nothing I could do to rescue him until I could tie Lucien Moriarty to the crime. Whether or not he was guilty was beside the point. The alternative was unthinkable. "Tell anyone I know about this auction.
tell anyone I'm coming, and I'll have you killed. No, I said, as Watson coughed. I'll do it myself. The door flung open behind me.
Charlotte,
August said cautiously, as the men behind him raised their guns. They both had greystone haircuts, military with better sideburns. Milo appreciated aesthetics. I relaxed marginally. August, I said, as it's polite to greet one's friends.
Charlotte, there's a girl on the roof. She says her name is Lena.
He cleared his throat.
She says she brought the helicopter you wanted.
11. In the back of Hadrian Moriarty's car, I had texted Watson some suggestions about fleeing. In the process, I'd also discovered a number of texts from my Sherringford roommate, Lena, informing me that she had decided to do some last-minute Christmas shopping in a European city and had chosen Berlin. Though, ew, Char, do they even have a Barney's? Because she was tired of you and Jamie dodging me. Is it because he's still mad at Tom? Tom and Lena, our Sherringford roommates, were dating. And no, Watson was not still angry at Tom, even though the little charmless frog had spied on him throughout last semester in exchange for cash. Tom had believed, erroneously, that his girlfriend, the daughter of an oil tycoon, would dump him if he didn't have the means to impress her with presents and trips and the like. Things Lena Gupta was impressed by in my experience with her? High-fashion jackets covered in snaps, spikes, and other metal hardware, unstudied eccentricity, things that exploded, boys who were willing to hold her bag, things Lena had zero interest in, other people's financial backgrounds. Lena was the kind of girl that let me draw her blood for an experiment without asking a single question. Lena never asked very many questions at all. This quality, among others, made her an excellent friend. When, outside the Moriarty's warehouse, I sent both her and my brother messages saying I might need medical assistance, Milo didn't immediately respond. Lena did. She wrote back, "Okay," and a number of those smiling faces with hearts for eyes. As Watson was being pummeled, I took the few seconds needed to send her our location before I joined into the fray myself. Lena arrived with a medevac helicopter, two nurses, a pilot, and a bug-eyed Tom with headphones on. Around her shoulders was a faux fur stole. It was beautiful. I was very happy to see her. "We should live together again next year," I told her as we helped Watson into the cabin. August climbed in next to the pilot. "Totally," she yelled back over the noise. "Do you think we could get a room in Carter Hall? They have private bathrooms." Watson was laid out on a stretcher, and though he was clearly conscious, he didn't try to speak. His jaw was swollen to the size of a grapefruit. Instead, he motioned for me to give him his phone. "Emails," he wrote with difficulty. "From Leander to your father? Are they on your phone?" "Yes, read them." I took his phone. The two nurses shooed me away. They put in IVs, shone penlights into his eyes. Tom looked over at Watson's battered face and then buried his own face in his hands. "Empathy? Delayed guilt?" I raised him a quarter of a notch in my estimation. I directed the copter to return to Greystone. There was a helipad on the roof and doctors inside the building. I wanted to avoid police involvement as much as possible, and taking Watson to a hospital in this state would certainly raise some red flags. They would take him down to the medical bay. August would run alongside to help them through the security checkpoints. Before they left, I told the nurses to check for internal bleeding. A reminder I'm sure they appreciated.
"You're not coming?"
August asked. "No," I said. "I need 3 cigarettes and 50 minutes in silence. I can't have a cigarette in a hospital room, and anyway I can't think when he looks like that."
"It might be a comfort to him," he said.
They were loading Watson onto a gurney. "His comfort isn't my priority." It was number 5 on the list, after all. "Give him my love, if he asks." August blinked at me, as though I'd said something strange. I wasn't unused to that look from him. In our time together in Sussex, when he was still my tutor, he'd often do this, blink at me slowly, almost languidly, when I gave an unexpected answer to his questions. Some might have taken it as a sign of judgment. I took it to be fascination. It never evolved past that place for him. never into attraction as it did for me. Still, he acted as though he had a claim on me. I wonder if he understood the nature of that claim. I was the instrument of his downfall. If he wanted to be near me, it was to ensure I didn't ruin anyone else.
He will ask,
August said. Then you'll answer. Go.
He did.
I'll hang here, Lena said. Don't worry, I won't talk. As usual, she understood me completely. When I looked over, she was playing Tetris on her phone.
Charlotte,
Tom said a bit awkwardly. No, I said. That shut him up. I pulled a lucky strike from my cigarette case and lit it. 4 long inhalations. My nerves lost some of their frantic hum. I missed that hum when it wasn't there, but I knew how to regain it quickly if I had to. I'm skilled at regulating my systems, though it's taken rather a lot of practice. Not to mention the several stints in rehab. In the next 28 minutes, I concocted, vetted, and finalized my plan. Honestly, I was pleased that August and Watson were for the moment gone. Democratic decision-making had failed us so far, as a team. Was that what we were? Things ran more smoothly when I was their benevolent dictator. We would go to Prague, to the art auction. I believed Philippa when she said she'd hold it. I believed her, too, when she said she wouldn't tell anyone about our presence. She did like her orchids, after all, and these auctions were her livelihood. She would set up armed guards and hope that my goals were as childish as she believed me to be. This wasn't to say that the auction would be safe. It wouldn't be. I simply had no doubts about our getting in. The particulars. Something about surveillance, I thought. Something about privacy. When I'd arrived at that horrid art squat yesterday, I'd spent some time wandering through the open studios, trying to gather my thoughts. The fight I'd had with Watson had affected me more than I'd liked, and my new location wasn't very soothing. Really, the sheer amount of blow available to me was impossible to ignore. When the second boy in 10 minutes offered me a bump, I declined with enough difficulty that I was concerned I would say yes the next time. I took myself away to a corner studio. The artist was missing, but his work was on display. It had to do with CCTV, those surveillance cameras that line both European and British street corners, and the means he'd concocted to avoid their gaze. He had a certain display of masks I found intriguing. I would get to that later. The last emails, then. I spent my second cigarette reading them through. I learned that Leander had pretended at times that I was his daughter. I had never pretended he was my father. Fathers were exacting and distant and cruel. Leander was none of those things. Still, I was charmed. More importantly, my uncle doubted his theory that Nathaniel was in fact Hadrian in disguise, and I did as well. How on earth had he been teaching a class? How had he made that work? Still, if there was any truth to it, I needed to know. I sent 3 texts to my brother. This time he replied quickly. He offered resources. He approved of my plan. His final text read, "I'm sure he wishes I was his son, too." Well, he only said it about me, I wrote back, with some pleasure, and then I turned my phone off. My next order of business was to confirm some minor financial details with Lena. We discussed a choice of clothing for the event, as I knew this would please her. I owed her quite a few favors at this point. We hammered out escape routes. She informed me that she'd entered my name into something called a secret Santa back in Sherringford. The other girls on our hall were to exchange presents when we returned in January, and according to Lena, my participation was mandatory. I told her I'd contribute a book on snails. She frowned and then shrugged in assent. That settled, I reviewed photographs of the Moriarty family. All blonde, all tall, all rather vicious-looking, even August, who'd taken pains in the past to soften his appearance with that particular professorial haircut. He'd pared himself down now. That guise was gone, and what was left was spiny and sad. Watson often compared our lives to art and entertainment. This was like a sitcom, that was like a circus. If that was the case, August Moriarty had gone from living in a campus novel to playing Hamlet, Prince of Denmark. The latter was more interesting, of course, but I may have lingered over the old picture of him on the Oxford website.
because that man, the man in the photo, was dead. He and I both knew it, and knew it was my fault. I wondered if our relationship now was a kind of shared mourning for the old August Moriarty. It's strange to grieve for your former self, and still I think it's something that any girl understands. I've shed so many skins I hardly know what I am now. Muscle, maybe, or just memory, perhaps just the will to keep going. When I looked up, still deep in thought, I caught Tom craning his neck to see my screen. I'm not particularly proud to say that I snarled at him. "Shar," Lena said mildly. She didn't take her eyes from her phone. "You're disloyal," I told Tom. "You proved that with Mr. Wheatley. I swear to you, if you ever give up sensitive information again, if you ever betray Watson again, I will find a way to wear you as a hat. Stop looking at my screen." Tom shrank back into his sweater vest. "I'll play you in Tetris," Lena offered. He nodded shakily. I was making quite a few threats today. It wasn't my favorite mode of operation, but it was to be expected when I was surrounded by petty criminals. I lit my last cigarette. Final matters. For this mission, I would need to recruit a few armed guards. Only those loyal enough to Milo that they would extend that same loyalty to me. Though I disliked working with those outside my circle, Tom, even now, was chewing gum as he sat across from me, I understood its necessity. I couldn't perform my role if I was preoccupied with pointing a gun. To that end, I sent one of the swarming mercenaries to find Peterson and a few others. They'd follow us to Prague. It was settled then. I smoked my cigarette down to its filter, coaxing my brain to slow its rapid patter. If I burned too hot for too long, I would go limp and useless. I would sleep. And so I had developed methods to cool myself down. Running through Latin declensions worked best. Amo, amas, amat were standard, if sentimental, and I did like running through the declensions for the body. Corpus has a lovely sound. But tonight, I only wanted the word for king. Rex, regus, regi, regum, rege. I inhaled one final time, waited a beat, then exhaled the smoke. The plurals now, and slower. Reges, regum, regibus, regis, regibus. I appreciated that flip and repetition. The dative, the accusative, the ablative. It had a certain musicality. I've always loved a counterturn. I stabbed out the cigarette. 48 minutes had passed. I asked the pilot to please start up the helicopter again, and kept my eyes trained on the door to the building. "You win," Lena said.
"You know, you look cute in a flight suit," Tom was telling Lena. Her eyes were guileless.
"We need to get you one, too."
"Did yours come with Milo's chopper?"
"No," she said. "I just had it lying around."
He grinned at her. Soon they were kissing. Noisily. I hadn't put on my protective headphones earlier, but I did now. When the door finally opened, August and Watson came slowly through it, followed by a small number of Milo's men. Watson had an ice pack against his face. He was sporting several bandages and a limp, but I was pleased to see he still moved with his usual stubborn determination.
"Are you fit to travel?"
"Yeah," he said. I had to read his lips with all the noise. "Nothing happened to you in that warehouse?"
"I happened to that warehouse."
He smiled, and then he winced in pain.
"Try not to move your face," I advised. "Do you remember what I said about Prague?"
"About us going there?"
Watson said it with some difficulty. I nodded. The pilot was motioning for us to hurry up. He'd take us to the airport, and we'd hop on Lena's father's company jet. Commercial travel wouldn't do, not this time. We were a strange group of people, and I didn't want us to be conspicuous. That would come later.
"What's the plan, Holmes?"
The stirring in my blood when he asked me that question, nothing in the world could replace it.
"Well," I told him, "I have a mask for you to wear." I'd heard it said before that Prague was a fairy tale city. Watson repeated it now as we made our slow progression in from the airport. Steepled roofs, pastel buildings, cobbled roads and switchbacks,
an astronomical clock that stood stories high in a public square. I'd been there once before with Milo when we were children. Our Aunt Araminta had decided we needed culturing. I think she may have mistaken us for bacteria.
It is a fairy tale city, Watson insisted. Look at those doors.
Our cab was descending a bumpy brick road, and every few feet we passed one of them. Medieval-looking metal doors, reinforced with spiny rows of hammered-in nails.
I wonder what's behind them.
On this street, souvenir shops. I disliked it when the term fairy tale was bandied about. Most often it was used to mean whimsical. This is inaccurate. In fairy tales, the forest swallows you up like a dinner. Your parents wrap you in a cloak and set you loose in the dark. Everything happens in threes, and only the oldest child survives. As a younger sister, I particularly resented that last implication. "We can buy you a commemorative shot glass if you'd like," I told him. He rolled his eyes, but I could tell he was pleased.
"Where are we staying?"
"Somewhere far away from all this madness. Someplace sensible."
"Define sensible."
The nurses had stuffed him with enough painkillers that he was able to talk without pain. He was, it seemed, taking advantage of that fact. My brother found us a bedsit flat near the auction house.
A bedsit?
It was quite expensive.
Holmes, we'll be on top of each other.
It doesn't have any windows either, so it's entirely safe.
No windows?
He flung an arm toward the window for emphasis.
The city's all lit up like a storybook. Tomorrow is Christmas Eve. We're in Prague. And you rented us a studio apartment without windows?
I frowned. I think it was originally a maintenance closet. It was only the two of us in this car. Lena and Tom had gone on ahead to their hotel. Though we'd flown in together, we'd arrive at the auction separately. For his part, August said he'd find his own place to sleep. He was aware that Watson and I had fought, and I imagine he was giving us the chance to kiss and make up.
I hate you, Watson said to me emphatically. What is it with you and closets?
They're often quite clean, and if they aren't, one can usually find cleaning supplies in them.
Holmes?
Actually, I booked us a room in an Art Deco hotel, I said, and moments later our car pulled into its circle drive. I'd always prided myself on my timing. Hats on, I said, handing him his, and sunglasses. Let them think we're film stars. I wanted no chance of our being seen.
You're awful, he said, laughing. I can't believe you made me think...
You just had yourself beaten unconscious. I thought we might as well get you a comfortable bed. Watson had laughed. His eyes had crinkled at the corners. Hours ago, I thought he might have been dead. There's also a view of the river, I said, and like a miracle, he laughed again. Oftentimes I withhold information from Watson for this very reason. He resents this, I think, my magic tricks. I don't know if he's understood yet who the reveals are really for. Inside, the desk clerk raised an eyebrow at Watson's battered face. Lawn mowing accident, I told her, and she averted her eyes.
Wouldn't there be blades if it had been a lawn mowing accident? He asked in the elevator. Wouldn't I be, like, sliced open?
It could have been a riding mower. You could have fallen off it.
Yes, he said. Please continue stripping my heroic act of all its heroics.
You did throw him to the ground, I allowed. Before he'd knocked you out, of course. The doors on our hall were all appropriately medieval. Hammered nails, stained glass, that sort of thing. When we found ours, Watson smiled to himself and let us in. We talked that night. It wasn't so different from these sorts of talks when we'd had them before. I want this, and what you want isn't possible, and what's left for us then to be to each other. I always felt as though he wanted us to reach a solution, as though he and I were a mathematical proof that simply needed to be balanced. For a very long time, I thought he considered me to be the problem, and then I worried he thought that I was the solution. I'm neither. I'm a teenage girl. He is my boy best friend. We would be everything to each other until we couldn't. The room had two beds, but we slept on opposite sides of the same one, and if I woke in the middle of the night in his arms, I can tell you that he slept through it. He slept through it too when I disentangled myself from him and went to sit alone on the bathroom floor until the screaming in my head subsided. I am in control, I reminded myself. I am in control. I took 14 breaths. I thought about the kit I had hidden away in my bag for emergencies, and then I forced myself to stop thinking about it. I am in control of this, I repeated, and felt better, and then I got back into Watson's bed. I had never wanted him to see me vulnerable, but what if showing vulnerability was a decision I myself made? Wake up. He stirred the smallest amount. Wake up, I said again. I need you to answer a question. This time he sat up. His face was a mottled wreck, eyes blackened, lips cut and bruised. Empirically, I knew that he needed sleep to heal, and if this wasn't so important, I would never have woken him up. I wasn't my great-great-great-grandfather. There was no pleasure to be had in ordering him into danger, in waking him before dawn. I preferred to watch Jamie Watson sleep, because if he slept and I was watching, he was safe. I would rather Watson be at home, doing research and reading novels, because one prefers to have their heart locked safely in their chest. When I loved August Moriarty, it was that I recognized myself in him, and saw that self redeemed. He and I were so alike in how we were raised, and how we saw the world, and he called what he needed from that childhood, and he resisted the rest with his whole self. He thought of others first. He read indiscriminately, traveled the world, listened to me when I spoke as though I wasn't an experiment or a wind-up doll, but a person, a complete one, with the contradictions that all people had. I wanted to be him, me, when I never wanted to be anyone else. If I wanted to be with him, it was because of that. And Watson? If August was my counterpoint, my mirror, Jamie was the only escape from myself I'd ever found. When I was beside him, I understood who I was. I spoke to him, and I liked the words I said. I spoke to him, and the words he said back surprised me, sharpened me. If August reflected me, Jamie showed me myself made better. He was loyal and kind, stalwart, like the knights from the old tales. And yes, he was handsome, even with a bruised face and a furrowed brow, miles away from the place we met or from the places we called home.
What is it?
His voice was thick with sleep. Do you want this? I asked him. I'd asked it once before, when I wanted to gauge how much distance I'd have to put between us if he did.
I think so,
he said.
Only, do you?
I took off my clothes. I'd been wearing pajamas, so it wasn't a particularly slow reveal or a seductive one. He watched me with shadowed eyes. When I reached for the hem of his shirt, he stopped me. I'll do it, his face said, and with a grimace he lifted it over his head. His torso was a wreck, battered purples and reds, and from the way he moved his shoulders, like an old tired boxer, it was clear that the painkillers he'd been given had worn off in the night.
Do you want this?
He asked me, with effort. I do, I said, and hated my voice for breaking. Can we get under the blankets? I lay down first, and he did next, gingerly, pulling the blankets over our heads like we were children. I had the insane urge to laugh, not because he was in pain, but because I was, too. I hadn't known my own motives until then. I was always so good with logic, causality. If we were both broken, then. After what would happen in the next few days, after I made the decisions I would have to make to get Leander back, to save my family from themselves, there was a chance that he'd never want anything to do with me. Otherwise, maybe I would have waited for this. A few more months, another year, see if I was able to heal any further. But I couldn't wait. And the fact of it was that I wanted him. With the back of his hand, he traced the line of my jaw, then down my neck, and I stiffened when his fingers touched my collarbone. His skin was warm, his breath was hot. He had far more experience than me, and I thought again, as I always did, of the last time anyone touched me this way, Dobson's thick fingers unbuttoning my uniform blouse, and I'd wanted to say something, anything,
but I'd taken enough opiates that the wires had been reconnected wrong, my hands too heavy, and... Watson stopped. He watched me, my face, and when I nodded, he gathered me up in his arms and kissed me, slowly, and we talked through it until it was over. I suppose I could recite the literal progression of events, but I find that I have some small reserves of modesty. We didn't have protection. We didn't have sex. We did other things. Dicere quae pudvit. Scribere jussit amor. I may, for some time, think about his beautiful arms. They are lovely, like those of a statue I once saw when I was a girl in a museum somewhere, back when I hadn't yet cried in my best friend's bed, in a hotel in Prague at dawn. When we woke, we dressed quickly, as we had things to do. We spent the next day holed up, fine-tuning my plan. That is to say, I told Watson the particulars and coached him on his dialogue until he rewrote it all in a fit of pique. The two of us had never worked in tandem like this before, not purposely. It turned out we were rather good at it. This took us through to lunch. I had Peterson bring the USB drive and our disguises and our props. At a certain point, Watson demanded a sandwich. I'd forgotten how often he ate. I made him ring room service for it, and then insisted he answer the door with his mask on. It went as planned. The delivery boy ran screaming down the hall. We didn't talk about kissing, or about getting back into bed. We played poker. He lost. We played euchre, and he lost again in gin rummy, and then he beat me an old maid, and then it was time for us to go.
"Do you have the USB drive?"
he asked, patting his pockets. "Of course," I said. "Do you remember what we're doing?"
"As Michel Foucault says in Discipline and Punish..."
"Excellent." I paused. "Try to enjoy this. Today. It'll be fun, I think, for you." Until it wasn't fun. Until he never wanted to look at me again.
"You know," he said, rubbing his eyes through the holes in his mask, "we might actually pull this one off."
I don't know why he sounded so surprised. It might be messy, awful, destructive, might end with a body count and my best friend disavowing me. But I do always pull it off in the end.
12.
"Of course we're on the list."
The clerk frowned down at his clipboard.
"I'm so sorry, Miss..."
Charlotte Holmes ran a hand through her short black hair. The Coke bottle glasses sitting on her nose made her eyes into huge, ridiculous saucers.
"Don't tell me you don't see Elmira Davenport. How dare you? Check it again."
She kept her arms bent at the elbow, palms up, and when she turned to me, she pivoted at the waist like a toy.
"I can't even believe that we're being subjected to the hegemony of lists. Lists! I am an artist. You are making me perform myself. This is unacceptable."
"Unacceptable," I intoned.
"I still don't see you," the man said apologetically.
"Fetch Philippa, then. There's surely been a misunderstanding."
A line had grown behind us, women in fancy dresses, men in suits and long coats, all shivering against the cold. Holmes clearly wasn't budging. The line behind us grumbled.
"Go on, fetch!"
He scampered off into the auction house and returned with the piggish, blonde Moriarty in tow. If I squinted, I could remember seeing her in that warehouse in Berlin. I couldn't remember much from that night, to be honest. The carpet, Holmes tapping my cheek, the vicious beating of the helicopter blades. The rest was gone. For someone who played contact sports, I didn't have a very sturdy constitution. Philippa stopped short when she saw it was the two of us.
"Philippa," Holmes said, "this is a party, quite a party. We are so excited, Kincaid and I. Such short notice for you to pull this off. Yes, very good."
"Very good," I intoned.
"Let them in,"
Philippa said at length. I was sure she recognized us. It wasn't important if she did. She'd known that we'd be there.
"But, madam," the clerk whispered, "they're not conforming to the dress code. I don't even know what to say about that mask."
With a shrug, Philippa escaped to the party. The clerk wasn't so lucky.
Kincaid, Holmes grinned toothily at me. Kincaid does not wish to be seen by the panopticon.
With her arms, she made a wild arc.
His mask pixelates his face, yes? The cameras on the street, the cameras in here. They cannot see him. He is the unsurveilled territory. This is his work, to disappear.
I am an artist, I intoned. I am my own work. She dropped her voice to a whisper.
And I wear these skinny jeans